This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest, who has the upper hand, President Obama or the GOP, as we race ever closer to the fiscal cliff?
I'm not going to sign any package that somehow prevents the top rate from going up for the folks at the top 2%.
Plus, a chilling photo of a doomed subway rider makes the world reconsider when journalists have a duty to intervene. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gap Fest, something decidedly old, handwriting, seems to be losing out to the keyboard. Should we care? Does how we write affect what we write? And then finally, the case against gay marriage. Not in general, but from one lesbian who just doesn't want to put a ring on it.
I don't want it. I want other people to be able to do it, but I don't want to do it.
We'll start with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz, coming to you this week from New York City. On today's program, we'll discuss the fiscal cliff. Are we closer to a deal or closer to falling over it? And then a shocking photograph on the cover of the New York Post. Should it ever have been published? Joining me today are Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
And from Washington, Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
The January 1st fiscal cliff is a week closer, and a deal to avert it is not. House Speaker John Boehner this week presented his offer of a deal, which proposed $800 billion in new revenue from closing loopholes and reducing deductions, and also new savings from raising the Medicare eligibility age and various cuts to government spending. Didn't include anything about raising income tax rates, especially on the wealthy, which is something that President Obama, of course, is insisting on. And as Speaker Boehner made this proposal, the House GOP also seemed to be considering what the left likes to call a doomsday scenario, in which they would not agree to any deal, rates would go up on January 1st, the sequestered budget cuts that are proposed would go into effect, and then when the government ran up against its debt ceiling limits in February or March, they would hold up the president, be in a much stronger negotiating position, and could negotiate with the president from a position of strength rather than weakness. So, John, is it your sense that we are any closer to a deal than we were a week ago or not?
Well, we're closer to a deal in that we're closer to the deadline. And we always knew that a deal was going to come probably right up against the deadline. I think that where we are probably in the end is there will be a short-term deal that rates will go up, maybe not all the way to the Clinton levels. Some cuts will be made in entitlements, and this will be a starter deal that will then have a bunch of provisions in the deal to launch long-term tax and entitlement reform in 2013.
Wait a minute. The Democrats are going to agree, the president has agreed to yet another short-term deal. Every time that President Obama agreed to a short-term deal in his first term, he got immediately held up the next time, and he just kind of screwed himself. Why would they do a short-term deal now when they appear to be in a much stronger negotiating position?
Well, there's no way you can do comprehensive tax reform and thoughtful, smart entitlement reform in 2 weeks. You just can't. I mean, it's impossible. And you wouldn't want to either, really, because if you're going to fix this ridiculous life at the brink that we live at now, right? We used to walk up to the brink. Now we just live there. You want the policies that deal with taxation and entitlements to go through the committees, to be debated, to take some time. And so what you would do is a two-part deal in which the first part wouldn't be just hitting the snooze bar. It would have although in the end it probably will be, because if you just judge the two sides of the two things, the second deal, the comprehensive deal, is going to be much bigger in size and scope. And so therefore, the first one necessarily has to be smaller.
But does the first one include a tax hike on the wealthy so that Obama can bank that?
Yeah. It's just he's not going to budge. And as somebody at the White House said, it's either going to happen the easy way or the hard way. Republicans are either going to give in on the tax rate question before the quote-unquote fiscal cliff, or they'll vote after the fiscal cliff, we go over the cliff. And in that case, they'll be voting for a tax reduction. In that case, they would be voting to cut rates on 98%.
Is there anything, Emily or John, in the Boehner proposal, which seems like a live option? Are there any good – what are the good and bad points of it?
Well, a bad idea is to raise the age for Medicare. And I'm not sure if that's specifically in its proposal, but
it is. I think it
running
is.
Around out there. You know, a better idea maybe is controlling the automatic inflation adjustments in Social Security. You could monkey around with that a little bit. And then I think a fine idea is asking for a bigger contribution to Medicare from the wealthy. The problem is that from what I've read, it doesn't seem like we're going to raise a huge amount of revenue from that.
Let's actually linger on this Medicare, raising the Medicare eligibility age, because I'm so with you on this.
It's so bad.
So the proposal is to raise it from 65 to 67. And, well, you tell me why it's bad, and then I'll tell you why it's bad, and we can agree.
Okay.
And, John, you can, if you have third reasons why it's bad, you can jump in.
I think it's bad because I'm still drawn to the dead Medicare for all idea that was part of health care reform. Medicare is a popular, fairly well-functioning government program that has held down medical costs better than most private insurers. And so the notion that you're going to limit it more and put off people's eligibility for it, to me, seems nuts.
Well, and the specifics are this, which is that when you do that, you indeed do save the government, the federal government, some money. The federal government spends less on Medicare. Indeed, that is true. It's some relatively small amount. All you've done, however, is shift those costs to citizens.
And then they get higher.
And those costs are much higher. When citizens pay those costs, they pay twice as much than when the government pays it. It's a because the government, through Medicare, has negotiated in volume discounts much lower rates for people. And the people, the industry that benefits from this is the healthcare industry, and doctors benefit hugely from raising the Medicare eligibility rate because they get, for those 65 and 66-year-olds, they get to charge them these ridiculously inflated rates. And it's just basically a giveaway to hospitals and doctors. It's a ridiculously bad idea.
Right. And yet, if you balk at the idea of government programs and you worry about socialized medicine, then it has all this natural appeal because it's shrinking and making more restrictive one of our most popular entitlements.
Right. And really what we should be doing is, as you say, you should be lowering the Medicare age, lowering it, and there's government has higher costs, but the country as a whole saves a huge amount of money because basically we stop paying doctors and hospitals as much as we're paying.
Right. Government pays more for Medicare by lowering, but not more than it pays for healthcare or more than the rest of us pay for healthcare.
Right.
Okay, John, now that we've had that nice agreement, would you like to step in with a contrary notion or just a point? Or
No, I mean, you're generally, you know, you're right. If Obamacare works, then this might not be the huge boon that David describes, mm-hmm. but you won't know that for 15 years.
All right, I want us to talk about the doomsday scenario, because every time I start reading about the fiscal slope cliff austerity bomb, this thing comes up and I'm literally like, really? Is that really possible?
I don't think it's a live possibility. I think that it's been over-torqued.
Isn't there a version of this where you don't even vote on the you don't do the vote on the taxes. The taxes just go up, and you wait for the debt ceiling showdown to happen again, and you
make your moment.
You make the whole thing gets negotiated when the Republicans have the debt ceiling, Democrats have taxes, and
yeah. But if you look at then you're talking about 2 months of enduring post fiscal cliff calamity, in which you have two things happening. One, you have the economy reacting to the going over the fiscal cliff, and there's much debate about whether business would really and the market would really freak out. But a lot of people who seem pretty smart suggest that this would be the case, and particularly consumer companies. I was talking to the CEO of a company that relies heavily on consumer purchasing, and they said they can see in their orders how confidence, but day by day, changes in terms of their call centers. So there would be an effect in going over the cliff, and then there would be an additional effect in challenging the full faith and credit of the
United States
federal
of America
government, or whatever we decide is the actual result of blowing the debt ceiling. So you'd have a double calamity at the end of 2 months of Republicans being blamed for starting the first calamity.
Right. And usually
politically, it's insane.
Yeah, the polls show that people are going to blame the Republicans, which is useful because hopefully it'll prevent them from doing this stuff.
I guess my view on all of this, and I'm wrong on everything, so I'm
not
a great
every
I'm a great contrary
thing.
Indicator, is that the Republican Party has behaved, particularly the House Republicans, have behaved at every turn in a way that is more extreme, more bizarre, more we're going to play chicken with you over the past 4 years than I ever would have expected. And therefore, even though they've had this huge rebuke Although these individual House members have not had a huge rebuke, I would point out. But
right.
the party has had a huge rebuke. I think it's very likely, or it's certainly possible, that they will do something that risky, that dangerous, and in an attempt to win a political game that they shouldn't try to win.
But hold on. Here's the thing. First of all, as you just answered your own question, two-thirds of the returning House members and newly elected House members in November won with more than 55% of the vote. Most of them are basically safe. Most of them are not only safe, but their constituents want them to vote against tax increases on anybody.
No, I guess I can believe it's one of these things where the individual interest of any House member is in one direction, the collective interest of the country and probably of the party is in the other direction. And it's not at all clear to me that when push comes to shove, that it comes down to the party.
It doesn't come down to the. I mean, there are a few people who kind of act for the party, but not really. They're all individual actors. Even John Boehner, who's, you know, kind of acting for his own legacy, but he's trying to get, you know, he has to basically keep in mind the individual views of the majority of his members more than he has to keep anything else in mind.
Well, we will check back. We will check back on this next week and in the following week.
And probably in the following week. Over. I lost so much sleep over the debt ceiling over the summer.
But can I ask you?
Wait, if you lost so much sleep, why would we need to wake you up?
That's a good question. All right, John, go ahead.
Well, no. So here's the question. Basically, this whole story has gone nowhere for 2 weeks. There's one thing to watch is the question of tax rates. That's the only thing to watch. And nothing has changed on that since the election. And so I wonder on a story like this whether we don't – I wish there could be some function to basically say let these guys play their stupid games and behave like children. But until they have an answer for this one question, we'll move on and talk about
totally
other things.
Totally agree. It's like the pause button and it's all a big West Wing rerun.
Coming up, do journalists have a duty to intervene in a crisis? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson. And this is the political GabFest portion of the show. If you have comments about our program, good or bad, harsh or loving, please visit our show page and let yourself be heard. WNYC.org/GabFest. Let's move on to our next topic. One of the most disturbing photographs ever published in an American newspaper, I think it's safe to say, was on the cover of the New York Post this week. A freelance photographer named Umar Abbasi, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, snapped pictures of Ki Suk Khan, who is a 58-year-old man pushed onto Manhattan subway tracks as a train bore down on him. Han was struggling to escape, was killed seconds after the photograph was taken. The New York Post put this on its cover with a headline, "Doomed." The alleged assailant was arrested later in the week, but that post photo prompted a series of debates. Should Abbasi have taken the photos at all? Shouldn't he have been rushing to rescue Han? Should the Post have run those photos, that particular photo, especially on the cover? And should we, as citizens, even look at that picture? So, Emily, should Abbasi have taken that picture?
If he was too far away to have done anything, which is what he claims, then I think it's okay that he took the picture. Because, first of all, that's the instinct that photographers have in moments of intense drama, like in war. That's just what they do. They make pictures. And it's their way of trying to change the world. Because sometimes when people look at pictures, they are riveted to do something. And in this case, it's possible there's some subway safety steps that could be taken in New York that could actually come out of this photo. So as long, I mean, what you don't, what you morally, I think, cringe is the notion that he stood there close by and instead of putting out a hand, shot the photo. That, I just don't, I don't want to believe that, and there's no evidence that that's true that I've heard.
Right. We don't yet know the full story, but his version is certainly not that he was attempting to stand back and avoid helping.
And no one's accused him of that. There were a lot of other people on that platform who had actually moved away from the assailant and the man who died because they were having this verbal altercation that was making everyone uncomfortable.
John, do you think Abbasi should have taken that picture?
Yes. It's his, you know, that's his instinct. That's what he does. You want the photographer to do that. Basically, you want, when something blows up, you want the photographer to take the picture. Now, whether it stays in his camera or never sees the light of day is then the next question. But I think, I mean, I can't imagine that I wouldn't have kind of lunged for to try to do something. He said at one point that he was trying to flash the camera to alert the subway driver. And I, you know, I don't know whether that would actually do anything other than blind the subway driver or whether that's plausible or what. We can't know what was actually going on in his head. The photographer is actually the last person in my mind because I'm thinking about the driver and the poor man on the tracks.
So I agree with both of you that it was, you know, as long as he wasn't actively avoiding an opportunity to save this person's life. Then we get to, I think, the much harder question.
The publication of the photo. And so this is what trips me up, because my instinctive reaction was to be just horrified that the Post published it. And part of it's that's a tabloid, but really it was just the appearance of this photograph. But why would it be okay for the photographer to take the picture? And if part of the reason you think it's okay is because they are trying to make people see, then the only way for us to look and think is if the newspaper publishes the photograph. So why does that choice seem so sensationalized and exploitive and, you know, all the worst things about newspaper journalism?
Well, I when I started to think about this, I thought about the way in which our wars have been sanitized. That one thing that's very striking about both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars is how very few images we have seen of the dead and of wounded, the wounded. And that's a very conscious policy by the Defense Department. The claim is that, you know, this is violative of the soldiers, it endangers national security, it lowers morale. There are lots of claims they make.
But I think
the main reason they do this is that they know, as from the Vietnam experience, that in general, the display, graphic display of wounded or dying or dead American soldiers would change how the American public thinks about these wars, would lower our interest and support of war. The country would have been much better served to have many more images of the actual costs of the war, both on American soldiers and on our enemy and on civilians in those theaters. But that seems to me a case where the images serve a public policy purpose, like a clear public policy purpose.
This one,
it's like much harder. So my initial reaction was it's much harder to make a public, that this benefits the public in some meaningful way. It's not, he didn't, you know, these pictures are not going to change how subways are designed.
Probably
there's no
not.
Debate. You know, it's not causing a
we could put up screens,
debate about
nothing else,
public
really.
Safety or, you know, it's it, the reason that they are published, it's basically prurient, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right. And then there's this, I was reading, I can't remember where, a powerful discussion of the idea that seeing someone before they have died who you know is about to die plays on your psychology in this especially prurient kind of horrible way where you're gawking at something in part because it's still happening in front of you. And of course, you're usually identifying with the person whose image you're seeing and imagining how you could escape being that desperate on the tracks. And the whole thing just starts to feel so uncomfortable and not the impulse.
And uncomfortable towards no larger purpose.
All right. But now I'm going to argue against my own point. So you guys, I mean, John, do you want to, I think you generally agree with that sentiment.
I think so. I mean, I was, you know, I went around and around on this as well. I mean, there's the poor man, the poor dignity of the man who's been killed and his, you know, life now, which has been summed up in this horrible image. So it's a personal affront to him and his family that all the sum total of his life is now this image. So at the end, I just kind of thought it is just totally prurient. And even though I'm generally in favor of people keeping in mind the fact that life is short and can end at any moment, I don't think that's really like a public policy purpose of a newspaper.
So, okay. So here's where this is not going to be a well-articulated argument, and I look forward to you guys biting my head off and to listeners also biting my head off. I would say the following, which is that the victim in this photograph is dead. He does not feel the pain of this photograph. His family and his loved ones, possibly they feel the pain of this photograph, but mostly they feel the pain of his death. And this photograph may, I suppose...
They did say that they were really troubled by it, actually.
It may be compounded, but mostly,
yes,
I think you...
Yes, Because think about the
identification we all have with him, hoping he'll run, in that moment in the picture that we see, he'll find a way out. They obviously feel that much more acutely.
Of course they do. And I would also not dare to make the case that this serves any public policy benefit. The New York Post clearly had the right to run this photograph. And I actually think that the choice they made is the right one. And the reason is this. The discussion is prompted. It's not a public policy discussion. It's prompted a huge outswelling of emotion, an emotion towards it's not like it's an emotion that's going to create change in society. But I don't think anyone comes away from this photograph, seeing this photograph, a lesser person. Or it has created a huge amount of thought in us.
Is it creating empathy, though? Is that what you're going?
Well, yes, no. And it is creating empathy. It's absolutely creating empathy. That's the right word. Thank you, Emily.
Do you think it is? Do people have? And did you have an empathetic feeling specifically for him and his family?
For him and for the driver. Yes, at that moment, and the sense of there's so few opportunities that we have in life to be confronted with genuine, huge emotions, and this was one. This was one that was presented to us, and we as citizens, people haven't responded to this with no one's sitting around making jokes about it. No one's like doing Halloween costumes based on this. No one's responded to this in any way except to sort of gasp in the horror of it and think in their own hearts about what that would mean for them to be that person on the track, or for them to be the driver, or for them to see this happen to their loved one, and. And I don't think that's a negative result. I think that that's a form of soul searching, which is not at all bad for people.
And I suppose also to give this its due, John, you were talking about how you hoped that you would lunge and try to save a person in this situation. I think we all have that hope for ourselves, whether it's in vain and forlorn or not. And I have a total terror of the subway and think about this basically every time I'm on the tracks. But I also had some moment of trying to imagine helping, which even if it's totally vainglorious and would never happen, maybe that's exactly the kind of empathy you're talking about, David.
There's some of that, too. And actually, one of the things that I found really heartening about this story is that the story of this death led to people talking about moments when people were saved. And there are a few examples of people who fall on the tracks who've been rescued by very, very brave people. And I don't think that this man died because there weren't brave people there. I think he died because it was a terrible set of circumstances and probably no one was in a position to help. But in so many other occasions, people try to rescue them. And that it was good to hear about that again.
You know, the other thing, though, that made me think that points in a different direction is that so one of the main causes of death in subway are people committing suicide. And if this was a suicide image, I think we would be horrified by it in a different level. And there is very good research that shows that copycat suicides emerge from exactly these kind of photos. I'm not saying that's what happened in this case, but you could imagine that. And I was reading how in Vienna, they actually really reduced suicide deaths by making it illegal to publish photographs just like this one. Now, our First Amendment would never allow for such a thing. As you said, the Post has the right. It's perfectly legal. But I was struck by the fact that there really did seem to be a cause and effect between that decision.
I think I would not argue the point I'm making if it were a suicide.
Right.
I think it's integral to the point I'm making that it be someone who is a victim of a crime. Here.
Right, because then we imagine these different dimensions of tragedy that are just a different set of facts.
All right, let's leave that discussion there. I'm very interested. Please, on the GabFest Facebook page, facebook.com/GabFest, please write in and talk about what your thoughts are on this and the publication of this photo. I, for one, would be very interested to hear lots of other views. That's it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of our show with more topics on our podcast. Visit slate.com/podcasts for more info. I'm David Plotz in New York, turning you over to Stephen.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. On today's show, Slate's own June Thomas says, "Don't be a wife," and we will query her as to why. And then the disappearance of handwriting with our own Julia Turner. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And our film critic, Dana Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
All right. Well, we're joined by Slate's own June Thomas, a contributor, columnist, bon vivant.
Bon viveuse. I don't know. Bon viveuse.
Yes. June, you write, "My resistance to marriage isn't about avoiding commitment or responsibility. I've been in a blissfully happy monogamous relationship for going on 16 years. We own property and are raising a cat together. I just don't want to be a wife, and I don't want a wife of my own." June, we're in hopefully just the very beginnings of the afterglow of a gay marriage being recognized as not only a legal right but a human right. It's this wonderful sense of accomplishment and euphoria. At the same time, it has to have occurred to many people and many individuals in the gay community. Thank you very much. I don't want to be married. And there are a whole bunch of reasons not to want to be married. It's certainly been occurring to the quote unquote heterosexual community for a few millennia. Now it's your turn. So I was kind of waiting for an essay like this to make an appearance and was so grateful that you were the one who wrote it. Why don't you walk us through why you don't want a wife and don't want to be a wife?
Well, let me begin with a lot of disclaimers. Of course, I want the right to marry. I want all of the civil rights and responsibilities that are available to heterosexuals who choose to marry. However, I have never, ever wanted to be married, and I certainly have never wanted to be a wife or a husband or any of those words. And I do wonder sometimes if it's just that I rejected what I couldn't have and cannot bring myself around to wanting it now just because somebody says I can have it. If somebody says you can't come to this party, the most natural reaction is to say, well, it, I never wanted to go anywhere near it in the first place. But with all that preamble, it's just really, is this supposed to be now the goal of any relationship? As you said, this is something that heterosexuals have struggled with for millennia, that only one kind of relationship gets a certain treatment. I mean, and of course, it's wrapped up with all kinds of things, you know, just as only some kinds of jobs come with health benefits and then some kinds of relationships come with that benefit. I suppose it is just a matter of catching on to problems that other people have experienced, but I don't want it. Mm-hmm. I want other people to be able to do it, but I don't want to do it.
Yeah, you make many great points in the piece, but one of which I thought was especially poignant was, yes, there will be all kinds of legal benefits to marriage. To gay marriage, there's a baseline of equality, of course, that finally is being achieved. But the other thing you talk about, which I really liked, was nomenclature and the sheer psychic convenience of having a single word or concept to cover your relationship, so that you don't, in fact, have to talk about it. In fact, right. You don't need to be especially public about it. Oh, this person is my wife. End of story. Everyone knows what you mean. I loved the paragraph on nomenclature.
It's always been a struggle. There's always been this awkwardness in gay relationships. Girlfriend, boyfriend sounds like you've just met or you're just getting to know each other. Lover, which was very popular in the 70s and 80s. It's just too much information. It just like starts people's minds rolling. Oh, stop. And partner, at least in this country, sounds kind of businessy and cold. And so, again, wife, husband, it is awfully convenient. But is convenience the height of what we're looking for? Can't we find some other way to find an acceptance of relationships that in many ways are just like other people's? But do we have to use the same word? Do we have to all be, you know, is it compulsory that we all behave this same way? I'm looking at Dana Stevens because I know Dana Stevens, a married woman, with some reluctance, I think, in a certain way.
Yeah, June, all I can think is, as I hear you talking, even though I'm a straight person, so I in some ways can't wrap my mind around what marriage must mean to you, but just rock on is all I have to say. Yeah, it's true. I guess you would say that I am technically married, but I don't use the words husband and wife, and not wanting to use those words were part of the reason why I didn't want to do it. And in a way, I mean, I said jokingly to you in a tweet the other day that I was frog marched to City Hall. It wasn't exactly a frog march, but I did essentially marry as a concession. It was not also something that I ever identified with or ever thought I would do. Mm-hmm. Then when it turned out that, you know, the partner that I was living with and I were having a baby, he sort of convinced me, although he also was not really on board for the sort of symbolic meaning of marriage, that maybe it would be a good idea for some insurance or tax reasons that right. We couldn't foresee. You know, he was essentially saying, this seems legally safer. There must be a reason why gay people are seeking this right. Maybe we should take advantage of it.
it, and it will be better for the legal situation of our child. And so for that and other family reasons, we sort of decided to do it as this concession to the state. And I still remember that when we were standing online in City Hall, I thought, I want to get off this line. This is not me. It's not something I want to do. But we had this friend who had gone, moved heaven and earth to come be our witness, who had a five-day-old baby at home, and I felt too guilty to get out of it. So now I'm married, and when I die, it's going to say in my obituary that I'm married and not unmarried and cool.
That is an important point, though, because I mean, I'm certainly not anti-marriage. I mean, we were at Julia's wedding. It was beautiful. It was lovely. It was such a happy, joyous day.
Oh, I love weddings. Are you kidding? Yeah. I love them. Love to cry at them.
And it's just, I don't want it for me. And I understand that there are benefits to marriage being a sort of on-off switch. You're either married or you're not. It's clear. And I do want people to be responsible. But is that the only way is, I guess, all that I'm saying ultimately?
Well, I think the thing that seems interesting here is that one side benefit of the deprivation of rights from gay people, which I agree with you, June, stipulated gay people should have the right to marry, and it's a better situation than them not having the right to marry. But in a world without the right to marry, there's a freedom to define a bunch of different possible ways that you could both have relationships, build relationships, the types of relationships that there can be and what you can call them, and the roles seem a little bit less defined and a little bit less rigid. Obviously, part of the purported value of marriage to society is that there is some rigidity in the roles, and there's a reason there's tax benefits and financial accounting benefits that, you know, the state, for whatever reason, thinks it would be great if lots of us got married, for reasons that still aren't totally clear to me. And there is a move away from marriage generally in society. I mean, fewer and fewer straight couples are getting married. More people are raising children in unconventional arrangements.
And I wonder how many more would do that if it wasn't for those benefits. I mean, they're tremendous. They're immense. And, of course, things that in my life have been extremely significant, things like not being able to get married and therefore bring a partner into the country legally. That's a huge thing that is, you know, clearly, seriously needs to get fixed. However, is marriage the only way, the only kind of relationship that we can recognize in that sense?
I know that there's a movement within the gay community that agrees with you, right? And,
yeah.
And Judith Butler, for example, the gender theorist who I studied with at Berkeley, always had this same kind of reticence toward gay marriage and has this great quote about she's been living with the same woman for 13 years. She says, if you ever try to marry me, I'll divorce you, right? There has been this resistance among gay men and lesbians. And I wonder how you see that fitting into the current, as Stephen called it, euphoria about the emergence of gay marriage. I mean, does that pit gay people against other gay people? Or do you think that the very granting of a right for marriage contains within it the right to resist?
I definitely do, and I do think there's a big generational split. One of the things I said in the piece was it started to not bother me because, you know, I really do think of this as a very libertarian thing. We should have the right, and then you have the right to do it or not do it. You know, it's not that big of a deal. However, I was just kind of tweaked out by these young women who seem blissfully happy, and I want them to be happy, but we're talking about their wives and fiancés, and it just feels like a throwback to, you know, another century. And however, they have grown up with this possibility. That's what they've always been dreaming of. And who the hell am I to say that they shouldn't have that dream? I do know that there is this feeling, you know, there's this thing, nostalgie de la boue, this feeling of wanting to be back in the mud. And I wonder if I am a little bit drawn to the sort of bad old days and, you know, being a radical and being a naughty girl.
Right. Is there a nostalgia for the closet? Is there a nostalgia for the gay bar? Is there a nostalgia for a pervasive feeling of being an outlaw in one's life?
Right.
In a way?
And there is that feeling of you heterosexuals, have set up this institution. And now I'm supposed to jump for it. And however, you know, people have written to me and said who live in countries where it's an established right, where gay marriage is an established right, where there is marriage equality. And they say to me that, yes, I understand your feeling that it's all very bourgeois and you're resisting it. But in fact, the people who benefit most are working class people whose families, you know, it gives them rights. It turns their families for some reason to being more supportive, and that in fact it's not all that bourgeois. However, it seems quite bourgeois to me.
I was struck by the lead of your essay, June, in which you talk about the fact that the advancement of gay marriage in New York means that people now just get to ask you really nosy questions about your relationship.
Exactly.
All the time. And in fact, we get to invite you on a podcast and grill you about it for 10 minutes. But there is something funny where people who might say, oh, I know June and she has this lovely girlfriend partner just get to come up to you at a cocktail party and be like, so you're going to get married?
It's like, true. It's an enabling of yentedom anew for gay people.
And again, a lot of people would say, finally, it's your turn now to hear that.
Excellent. Well, June, thank you so much for coming on the show. Can you just say you people?
You one- people.
Exactly. Thanks for coming on. We'll see you soon, I hope.
I hope so.
The essay, once again, is called Don't Be a Wife. It's on Slate.com by June Thomas. Seek it out. It's wonderful. Coming up, the disappearance of handwriting. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. By the way, we'd love to hear your comments about our program. You can put us on a pedestal or knock us off a pedestal. Take us to task. Go to our show page and tell us what you think. It's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, on to our next segment. All right, well, when was the last time you filled a page of foolscap? So asks our own Julia Turner in an essay she's written for Slate. When was the last time you filled it with lines and lines of unbroken lettering, trying to express an argument or make a developed point? When was the last time you used pen and ink for writing and not just for jotting? Julia, I know you well enough to know that when you write something for Slate, it's usually because something has captivated you. It's really sparked a train of thought that you had to share publicly. You're not a compulsive writer like the rest of us. And therefore, and it comes through in the essay, right, that the idea of handwriting and what handwriting is and how it's going to be potentially lost and lost completely in the age of the word processor, that must have gotten you going on a personal level. So I want to hear what attracted you to this essay, and then we can talk about the book that you're reviewing in a moment.
Well, our books editor, Dan Coyce, who's been a guest on the show, said, hey, there's this great new book about handwriting. Do you want to review it? And do you have thoughts about handwriting? And is your handwriting good enough that you could write either all or some portions of the review in handwriting on the site, which I did. Some of the review appears as text and some of it appears as my own ungainly print, which you can all go check out on the website. And I spouted off a bajillion ideas about handwriting. He's like, it sounds like you do have opinions about handwriting, so you should review this book. But I was very surprised by the process of reading it. I thought I was a handwriting sympathizer. I'm someone who likes handwritten thank you notes and thinks that to-do lists should be kept on paper. And in general, and I have an extensive collection of absurd stationery and pens and preferences about which ones I use in which situations. I like writing things by hand. And so I assumed that I would read this book, be persuaded by its argument that we should all lament the demise of handwriting, and write a stirring endorsement of the book and its argument. And instead, I read this book, which is by a British novelist called Philip Hensher. It's a nonfiction book, somewhat about the history of handwriting and somewhat about just what it means to us as a society and a culture and personally and individually. And I just had the opposite response. The more I read, the more it seemed that handwriting is a flawed technology that has not been around for very long and certainly has not been taught to or used by the vast bulk of society for very long, and that typing is a swifter, clearer, better way to communicate with one another, and that instead of lamenting that when we text each other, we don't get to enjoy the distinct flourishes of each other's Y's and B's and P's and Q's, we should embrace it. If I send you a text, you probably know what I'm saying. If I write you a note, you probably have to puzzle over it and throw it out. All right. So that was my journey.
let's return to the midpoint of the journey quickly. What's the strong argument in favor of handwriting? Right? Does it have neurocognitive effects? Does it bring us to a level of intimacy with our own words and our words as we give them to others? What is Hensher's most sentimental, like persuasively sentimental case that he makes in favor of handwriting?
Well, I think the main case in favor of handwriting is that you can see the person on the page. You keep hearing in Hensher's book and other laments for the loss of handwriting this notion that there's something about handwriting that reveals our fundamental character or personhood or mood or aspect, and that when you get a note from someone in pen, you are somehow feel closer to them or understand their person more than you would if you got what classically gets described in these handwriting apologias as, you know, cold, unfeeling text or plain type, which can convey no personhood through it. So that's the argument he makes. There is also sort of a neurocognitive argument that perhaps in the art of learning handwriting or making letters as a child, we internalize the processes of language and thought and thinking in a way that we might not otherwise. He doesn't really get into it, but some people make that case. And then I think there's also an argument about composition that perhaps if you're composing in longhand, you have to turn off the part of your brain that always wants to edit the prose you've written, and you just get it down on the page in some fundamental creative spurt of excellent, you know, juices of brilliance that flow out as the ink flows from your pen. So I think those are kind of the three main arguments, and I think that they're basically all bogus.
Dana, you, like me, are an ink-stained relic from another century. Surely you have some attachment to the quill and the parchment.
The nib. I feel like there are defenses of handwriting to be made that are very practical. I think everything that you're saying about the consumption of text is probably true, that it's easier and clearer to communicate via a printed text. But what about the production end? I do feel like, and I mean, seeing a six-year-old learn to write, I see this every day. I do feel that the act of learning to wield a pen and form letters and express yourself through those letters is a very profound moment in the evolution of a person's mind, right? And it's obviously has been a profound moment in the evolution of the human species as well. That doesn't mean it's something that we nostalgically cling to and not accept new technologies, but it seems to me that there are a lot of arguments to be made for handwriting that aren't sentimental at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, in addition to, I guess, the one I just made is neurocognitive in nature, if I'm talking about, you know, the way that learning to write changes your brain. But there's also just the excellence of the technology. I mean, pen and paper offers all kinds of things that typing on a computer doesn't. For example, it's cheap. It's portable. You can do it without electricity. You can do it anywhere. I think these are some of the same reasons that the book, the bound codex book, isn't going to disappear as fast as all that just because there are electronic augmentations or substitutes for it. It seems to me like both of them are profound, simple, and beautiful technologies that that still have relevance.
Yeah, beautifully said. I mean, Dana, I mean, I'm sure you were struck, as I am, by how quickly a young child makes the transition now from, you know, really almost from, you know, uttering their first inchoate words to facilely using a microprocessor, right? They leap over this cognitive stage that we lingered on as kids, you know, where you actually have to manipulate pen and paper, right? They go to a keyboard and a screen very quickly.
But they're two completely separate things. I mean, I don't see that in my everyday life. Yes, I can see my daughter acquiring facility with a computer screen, actually more slowly because she's not allowed to use it as much as she has to use pen and paper for school. But now in first grade, she's got writing homework and she has to write something every day. And I see the thrill and the excitement and the transformation that happens when she takes pen to paper. I think a computer is more part of something that surrounds her. It's an appliance. Mm-hmm. It's part of the environment. I'm not saying she doesn't love it and she doesn't interact with it, but I'm saying that pen and paper have given her a new kind of subjectivity.
Right. I want to be clear. I don't have a huge horse in this race, right? Like, I mean, as soon as something becomes a successful tool of expressivity, it is made noble, whether it's more like a gadget or more like a, you know, ancient accoutrement, you know, stretching back millennia or whatever. What I do want to say, though, is I do think, Julia, and I wonder if you agree with this at all, that composing one's first draft on a word processing program, which is how most people now are going to learn how to write going forward, the idea that you will compose a draft that you can't correct as you go. In fact, the whole idea of successive drafts and discrete drafts of a document really is going to go out the window pretty much, right? And the one thing about handwriting, or one of my absolute heroes, a professor of mine at Yale who's also quite a successful essayist, he still types on a typewriter, and I don't think he's a nostalgiac. I don't think he's doing it for the nostalgic thrill. I think he's doing it because he wants there to be a discrete draft, right? Don't we produce more slick, more facile arguments on a word processor than we would if we were forced to write it, have it be an object separate from us, leave it and come back to it and look at it and then have to begin again from the beginning.
Well, I don't know that I agree with that last thing Steve said. Let me just say, I think that's a generational thing. And I'm sure for your professor, that is the best way to write. I'm not sure that that means that it should be passed down to the next generation.
Yeah, you guys are full of bogus straw man arguments here. First of all, I am not arguing that children should not learn how to form letters. Like, clearly you need to be able to, like, make notes and, like, leave a buy milk note on the kitchen counter. And even though many people have more access to better technology now than did 10 years ago, you know, we're not all born with iPhones implanted in our palms. So I believe that children should learn to form letters and that we should all be able to print. But should schools invest, you know, much more time in encouraging students to develop both print and cursive styles of writing and cultivate a style of writing that really represents their spirit and is elegant and, you know, needs to be legible to others? I don't think so. Most of the notes we jot are for ourselves at this point. And in terms of composition, I mean, does either of you compose in longhand? When is the last time either of you composed a piece of writing in longhand?
Well, I write with a pad and pen right next to me. I mean, I compose in Word, but I do have a pen and paper next to me. And actually, I've been trying to have a pen and paper with me more all the time now because I do feel like having a notebook in which you jot down ideas and things that you notice and quotes during the day is something that I wouldn't do. I wouldn't get out my phone and tap in a quote that I read on the subway. I would write it on a piece of paper.
Really? I just tap it out in the notes app on my iPhone. And I, you know, and I also travel with a notebook all the time and I use it to take notes in meeting. I mean, I do use both forms. But I think, you know, I have experienced, Steve, what you're talking about with the facility of composition on a word processor can make you think that you've written something that is good and done because it looks good and done. Like, you know, if the assignment from the professor is write a two-page paper, once you've tapped and you've got a two-page paper, it just looks like a two-page paper. Put Julia Turner at the top, you know, History 302, Section A, and you can turn it in. And the rigor of the editing process and learning how to write properly isn't necessarily built in. On the other hand, I am willing to bet that if you went back and looked at the years of papers that were initially composed in six drafts on longhand on legal paper and then eventually got typed up, that as many completely shitty papers were turned in that era as are turned in today. I bet they were in a slightly different way. Like, it's harder to write in longhand than in type. So I think there's a certain bloviating style of the word processor bullshitter. You just fill
logarithmic,
you kind of
excess.
Fill up the page with more stupid words as opposed to eking out fewer ones and playing with the spacing and the margins. But those, to me, do not seem fundamental to the technology.
Okay, let me come at this from a slightly different angle. Dana, you and I are probably old enough to both have this similar memory, which is that when I was in high school and college, I used to write letters to my friends, and I would actually write them out in longhand. They'd be several pages long, and I would fold them up, and I would stick them in an envelope, put a stamp on them, and Uncle Sam would deliver them. And then over time, I had shoeboxes filled of replies. And it was this whole kind of record of my existence starting at the age of, let's say, 13 up through about maybe the age of, I don't know, you know, early to mid-20s. And then email kicked in. And part of what's wonderful about that old shoebox full of letters is that people's personalities really do express themselves, I think we can all agree, in their handwriting in an utterly distinctive way. And that limited to X number of fonts is just not going to substitute for that degree of intimacy, that something they transmitted their person through their writing and through the mail in a way that really email won't. I'm not being just a crazy old sentimentalist that email won't ever substitute for.
Yes, you are. I mean, it's the words you use. It's what you say in the letters. I mean, it's charming to get a postcard. I still send postcards. But, you know, I have a whole, you know, floppy disk full of emails from my friends, best friends in college that we all sent around, my high school friends when we separated. And, you know, they're delightful. They're great. And they, all of our personalities shine through in just courier, single space courier.
I am not robbing you of your own experience by stating that mine was better.
Stop f***ing on her floppy disk.
And richer and more distinctively human than yours. Can you please stop hearing criticism in everything I say? Jeez.
I don't know where I would get that idea.
No idea.
But I just wanted to say, just think about the handwriting of the people you love and how important it is to you. Have you ever fallen in love with someone without fetishizing their handwriting? Think about finding an envelope from an old boyfriend, you know, and remembering their handwriting and what it looked like. And when I think about you guys, I have no idea what your handwriting looks like. I guess I know Julia's a little bit now because it appeared in this piece, but I think we all need to submit a handwriting sample and put it online so we can learn to know each other.
I know Steve's handwriting from the palimpsest document he uses to write up the show notes, the intro and the kicker every week.
Don't you think that a criminal psychologist would recommend that I were put away forever?
I'm not sure we can release that.
Of this tortured scrawl? Oh, my God. That represents my inner life.
Graphology, 911.
I have definitely fallen in love with someone without fetishizing his handwriting, namely my husband. I don't think there was any written correspondence as part of our courtship.
So when you look at his handwriting, you're just indifferent, or do you think, oh, this sucks?
No, it's perfectly fine. But I just, like, he did not woo me by pen. He wooed me with words, but they came in texts and emails.
So it's the taffety tap of his fingers on the keyboard that
chills.
Gets your heart going.
Yeah.
Julia's dead insides.
Oh, her impoverished soul cracks me up.
Moving on. All right. Well, in case we didn't say it, the book under review is called The Missing Ink. It's by the British novelist Philip Hensher. And the piece up on Slate is by Julia Turner. It's called The End of Pens. All right. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
My endorsement this week is a piece of Twitter fiction. There's a writer named Elliot Holt, a novelist who I follow on Twitter, who's a delightful tweeter in general and just a fun person to chat with on there. But she did this little experiment the other night where she wrote a story on Twitter, and it got a lot of pickup. It was written about on Slate as well, and it's just something really interesting and nice use of the medium. What she did was create three different personas, not herself, put them in a situation, and create a mystery. So this woman at the beginning of this tweet sequence falls off of a roof during a party, and then the rest of the tweets are either from, I guess it's from her during the course of the party, from people that she interacts with, and there's a question at the end. Did she commit suicide? Was it an accident? Or was she murdered? And it's a really fun experiment with the medium and something I hope more people will be using it for. So the tweets are all gathered together by Penguin Press, and we'll put a link to a place that you can follow the whole storyline.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah, it sounds very cool. Julia, what do you have?
I have a micro endorsement today. If you are on Instagram, I recommend that you follow the Instagrams of Jethro Mullen, someone named Jethro Mullen. Don't know who they are or how I came to follow them, but he, I think it's a guy, takes beautiful pictures of Hong Kong, and I have a hard and fast policy of never looking at travel magazines and throwing out the travel section of the New York Times as soon as it arrives because I feel like I don't want to see pictures of places that I may one day go. I'd rather just be surprised by what they are like when I eventually get there in the optimistic future that I envision for myself where I go to all of these places. But these pictures of Hong Kong are really beautiful and compositionally really interesting, and if you're on Instagram, follow this guy Jethro Mullen.
That sounds really cool. So I have the totally most unoriginal endorsement probably of all time. I've come to it late, as I always come to such things, but I'm now watching Breaking Bad, and the reason I'm endorsing it is the value add here is not the show, which everyone's heard of, and everyone who's going to watch it has probably either started it or ordered the discs or whatever, but I actually didn't like it at first. And one of the things I'd always heard was that the best season was sort of starting midway through the first season through the end of the second season. I'm here to tell you that if you persist, it gets progressively better even after that. It's really the third season of Breaking Bad where finally I am completely connected to the characters, principally Hank, who I think is just truly one of the great characters in American television history. All right. Well, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks a lot, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Vuolo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. And the executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week. Take a step, I know. See, she came in the left, she goes in the corner.